questions about anything? So I've been advertising the stars to know, which are listed online in the context of exam 3. And we'll start on those next time. And what I'll do is I'll give you a sheet probably pretty much identical to this that has dots and lines for the constellations of Perseus and Ursa Minor. And what you have to do is put your name on this sheet and put a little arrow that points at Polaris and spell out more or less correctly the name of Polaris, and a little arrow that points to the star on this side that is Algol, and more or less correctly spells out the name of Algol. Right? So it's mostly just a warm-up to do the larger groups of stars, and I think we'll be able to get all of these stars done by the time of Easter break. So after this, we'll do one of the groups of three, Summer Triangle or the Big Arc, and then the last thing we'll do is the group of eight, the Winter Hexagon. Questions? So this should be our last day on Earth, whatever that means, and then we'll go on to the Moon, which is in Chapter 10. The strategy of having people switch from Monday to Wednesday looks like it's going to work out, because at least currently the forecast is for mostly clear tonight. Lots of people forgot that once we have daylight savings time, the lab time switches. So now an hour later, so don't show up at 8:15 unless you want to wait outside the observatory for an hour. 9:15 and 10:30 are the appropriate times for the observatory. If you're in a Monday lab and you really want to try, and it looks clear, and you really want to come out to the observatory, there should be space. It looks like there's still a couple of spaces in each lab that could be filled by people. Questions? Okay, so we had one final topic from atmospheres, and that had to do with ozone, which is kind of a success story, I would say, although, you know, things aren't right yet, but it looks like things can be made right. So first of all, ozone has kind of a strange relationship in the news. So you'll hear about ozone warnings when ozone is close to the surface of the Earth and it could hurt your lungs if you're breathing. And you also hear about the requirement to have ozone 50 kilometers up, where we have it absorbing ultraviolet light. And absent the ozone layer, the surface of the Earth would probably be sterilized, or we would have to adapt quickly to having deadly UV light in abundance hitting the surface of the Earth. So the story is kind of a little bit incredible again, because I mean the atmosphere, the ocean, those are big places, and it's kind of hard to believe that people could have a noticeable impact on those huge bodies, and we really can't have an impact on them in bulk. But turns out we can affect the rare constituents in the atmosphere, and we have done that with carbon dioxide, and we were doing that with ozone also, and we were doing it not so much because we have, you know, hundreds of power plants that are spitting out carbon dioxide, but we do have refrigerants which are always leaking out of people's air conditioners, not in a huge amount, but it turns out that the decay products from the refrigerants were not able to destroy ozone on a one-to-one level, but do it catalytically. So where one chlorine atom might destroy 1,000, a million ozone molecules and be not destroyed in the process, be regenerated in the process. And it turns out that this was kind of an odd situation. The refrigerants that we now consider bad, the chlorofluorocarbons, were originally good because they were highly non-reactive. They replaced things like ammonia, which worked good as a refrigerant, but if they leaked out, could kill people. They also smelled, ammonia also smells bad, so you could detect the leaks pretty easily. So these things were leaking out, being highly non-reactive. They just hung around in the atmosphere, and they had time to work up to the stratosphere, and then they were broken apart by ultraviolet light, and they released chlorine up there, and the chlorine is the thing that damaged the ozone layer. So the plan was to replace these guys with things that were a little bit more biodegradable, and so they wouldn't last long enough to get into the stratosphere and destroy the ozone layer. So now we have old refrigerants like R22 and R12, and we have more modern refrigerants. And so as a result, if you have a leaky air conditioner, it costs a whole lot more in order to recharge it with the corresponding refrigerant. Okay, so ozone, good, bad, fingers crossed, problem solved. So then it's on to the Earth. So for the atmosphere, we divided things up in kind of a strange way because the composition of the atmosphere is pretty much the same top to bottom. So we're going to divide up the layers in the Earth's atmosphere, in the Earth's interior, based on composition and state. So kind of not surprisingly, over 4 billion years, the heavy stuff has sunk to the center of the Earth. So we have iron and nickel at the center of the Earth. And of course, the hottest part of the Earth is the center of the Earth. So at kind of first blush, you would guess that if any part of the Earth is going to be molten, it would be the center of the Earth. And it turns out that's not the case. While high temperatures break apart composites and try and break apart solids into liquids, high pressures do the reverse. And it's kind of a very close match that the high temperature at the center of the Earth loses to the high pressure at the center of the Earth. So in fact, the innermost part of the Earth is solid iron and nickel. The outer parts are hot enough and low enough pressure that it is liquid. And in fact, it's convecting liquid. That liquid is being stirred around. Then we have more rocky material that has a lot of silicon dioxide mixed into it, but it's still iron rich, and that's the mantle. And kind of the word for iron rich rocks are mafic rocks. And we have a discontinuity in composition between the crust and the mantle, where we have the lower density rocks that are granite, for example, as opposed to peridite, which would be a good mineral for the mantle. These sort of felsic rocks are floating on the top, and the discontinuity between the crust and the mantle is called the MOHO. Oddly enough, we also have a parallel decomposition of the top part of the Earth based on how rigid it is, its viscosity. So the lower part of the Earth is plastic, and I guess our book warns that plastic may not mean what you think it means. So plastic, usually we think about plastic things as being hard, but technically speaking, plastic means things more like silly putty that are somewhat fluid-like. So the asthenosphere is not swishy fluid-like, but more like tar or something like that that can flow over time, given the possibility. And the lithosphere is the part of the Earth's outer region that is, in fact, rigid. And the lithosphere encompasses all of the crust and a little bit of the mantle. So this somewhat viscous layer, somewhat able to flow layer, is not the exact top of the mantle, but top-ish on the mantle. So diagrams like this very commonly are things that I ask you to be able to reproduce for exams. So it's one of the innovations of the 1950s or so to understand that the continents are in motion. They're not in the same place all the time. They're moving around, and not that hugely long ago, they were actually all together in one spot. And then they've broken apart to give us the various continents that we know today. So it's a slow process. You don't have to worry about buying a new map every year. Continents are only moving kind of maybe at most 10 centimeters per year. So jet travel isn't getting more expensive because of the increased distance to Europe. It has more to do with the price of oil. So the idea is that if these plates are moving around, there must be some place where new plate material is being created and other places where plates are being destroyed. So where plates are being destroyed are called subduction regions, where one plate moves under the other, and as it goes down into the mantle, it melts and joins the mantle as a whole. Some of it is low density stuff, so we tend to have volcanoes forming in the vicinity of these sort of subduction zones. Okay, and here we have a mid-ocean rift zone or mid-ocean ridge. These things are usually a little bit higher than the surrounding territories. Here we have liquid rock magma coming up, forming dikes in this region and pushing these two layers apart. So that's where crust is being created. Okay, so here's the asthenosphere, the partially molten zone. And what's happening is we have convection that is what we think about as being the solid surface of the Earth is just kind of the scum layer on top of this partially melted zone, which is convecting. It's pulling this piece of crust to its eventual destruction. So we have convection in the asthenosphere, which is, you know, kind of causing the whole shebang. I don't know, more of the same. So, as I say, the crust is literally floating on the asthenosphere. So if something is high, it must be like an iceberg. It must have a corresponding root. Right? So the reason we have continents is because they are relatively thick, low-density material, and so they're sitting above the current ocean level. The reason we have mountains is because they have roots. And if a glacier were to come along and level this thing out, you wait a few million years and you would expect it to pop up, just the way an iceberg would pop up if you covered up the top. So this balancing of rock is called isostatic balance or isostatic equilibrium, and it isn't the case with all mountains. Some mountains are being supported because we have continents in collision. For example, the Himalayas. You know, we can have things like this where we have two continents that are running into each other and they can push up mountains and they're not in isostatic equilibrium. But the Appalachians, for example, are a perfect example of that. They've been wiped out by several glaciations and they keep popping up because they've got roots. We can also have cases where one piece of rock is moving sideways to the other. And that's actually what's happening off the coast of California. It's not so much that we have subduction going on there, it's that we've got one plate that's going north, the Pacific plate, and one plate that's going south, which is the plate that holds most of North America. Generally speaking, of course, the places where we're going to have earthquakes, and I think I showed you that video, what we have here is sticking for a while, which builds up stress in this layer, and then that stress is relieved by having this thing boing back. So earthquakes, generally speaking, are present where we have plates in collision, like, for example, California. Oddly enough, the biggest earthquake that's occurred in the United States happened near St. Louis, right, which is not near any plate boundary. It's an old rift zone. Rift being this sort of situation where we have the continents being ripped apart. So, now how do we know all this stuff, right? We can't literally see inside the Earth. So the way we learn about it is we need some wave that the Earth is transparent to, and sound is good. Sound works just fine in going through the Earth. So we can have an earthquake, which produces a loud noise, and we can listen to the echo of it as it bounces off these various layers. And it's important to recognize that while sound, as we've talked about it in class before, is a pressure wave where we have air being pushed together and expanded, solid rock also can propagate shear waves. So we can distinguish between shear waves, which require solid material, and pressure waves, which can go through solid rock or liquid or gas. And you can see here that there are no S waves in this outer fluid core. So that's how we know that this is fluid. It doesn't support shear waves. And the inner core does support shear waves, so that's how we know it's solid. So incidentally, this asthenosphere, you notice it does have S waves. So that's why it's not literally liquid the way water is. It's more like silly putty or tar. It can have it has a restoring force if you push it sideways for short periods of time, but over long periods of time, you push it sideways and it'll kind of melt into each other. Okay, so we can measure these velocities, and from these velocities we can get a handle on what the materials are. It's not a perfect match, that is to say there are lots of different materials that have pretty much the same velocity of sound in it, but by using the velocity of sound and the density, which are things that we can get out of the sound waves, we think we have a pretty good idea of what's on the inside of the Earth. But as you might guess, I mean, there are always slight arguments about, you know, what is exactly the chemical composition of the inner core. Yeah, it's going to be mostly iron and nickel, but is there some oxygen in there? Is there some sulfur in there? Those sorts of things are not going to be well revealed by the somewhat limited data we have, right? Just wave velocities and densities. And I hope it's clear that it's going to be much worse when we're talking about the other planets. So we have seismometers, things that listen to earthquakes on the moon, but with that exception, we don't have any such information on the other planets. So we have very limited ideas about what's on the inside of Venus and Mercury, mostly based on calculation. So we know how much rock weighs, we can figure out what the pressure is, and we can kind of guess what the temperature is as we go inside those planets and try and work out what the interiors are like. One very important clue is the presence of a magnetic field. So we've said that the sort of magnetism that we're used to, permanent magnets, that doesn't exist at high temperatures, temperatures above the Curie point of the material. So the magnetic fields in planets are not permanent magnets, they're electromagnets. And if it is an electromagnet, then we need an electrical current. And of course, if we have a current, we're going to need a power source of some sort in order to run that current. And it turns out that the power source, only power source we can think about, is convection. So the requirements for a planetary magnetic field are to have a convecting, electrically conducting fluid. And what is playing the game for us, of course, is this outer fluid core. So we think that this thing is sloshing around pretty much like water. So distinguishing the characteristics of water and, say, honey doesn't slosh around nearly as well as water. The word that describes that is viscosity. So the viscosity of this outer fluid core is quite low, more like water, whereas this asthenosphere, it's has a viscosity maybe of tar or something like that. So it's not convecting anything like the velocities that we have in this outer fluid core. If we do the mathematics of how we can create a magnetic field from a convecting conducting fluid, it turns out that there's no guarantee that the magnetic field is going to be oriented in any particular direction. So for example, the Earth is spinning in a particular direction, and I think, as we've said before, the North Pole is technically speaking a South Pole in the Earth. There's no particular reason it has to work that way. And for other planets, we see exactly the reverse situation. And what we know from the mathematics is that since there's no definite relationship between the planetary spin and the resulting magnetic field, there's no reason that this thing can't spontaneously reverse. In the case of the Sun, we see that it does spontaneously reverse on an 11-year cycle. So does the Earth's magnetic field reverse? Well, it hasn't reversed in recorded history. Well, we can do better than recorded history because, of course, the orientation of the Earth's magnetic field is going to be recorded anytime we have rock that has solidified. So if we have rock that solidifies in the presence of a magnetic field, it turns out that the material will be slightly magnetized as a result. So we can figure out the direction of the magnetic field just by examining rocks that have solidified at various ages. So we have rocks that solidified 5,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, 100,000 years ago. We can work ourselves back, and certainly what's the case is the Earth's magnetic field hasn't reversed in millions of years, but it looks like it has been reversing on and off at about a million years per reversal, as far back as we can go. So first of all, the reversal cannot take place on one day it's north, one day it's south. It's guaranteed to take thousands of years in order to switch. And exactly how long it takes it to switch, you know, that's something that people argue about. But I don't know, if you're interested in this sort of thing, you might want to know that the Earth's magnetic field is decreasing currently and has been decreasing in recorded time. So if we kind of linearly extrapolate that out, it's going to reverse in 1,000 years or 10,000 years. I don't think anyone actually believes that. There's probably some fluctuation that is constantly going on, and then we have a big fluctuation and that causes a reversal. But the details of this are not recorded in rock very well, because typically, if we're going to measure the ages of rocks, we're talking about things that have an uncertainty of a few percent, and we're talking millions of years, so so it will seem like an instant, this 10,000 years, that it takes the Earth's magnetic field to reverse. The reversal of the Earth's magnetic field potentially has big repercussions. The Earth's magnetic field is doing lots of good stuff for us. Its magnetic field is protecting us from the solar wind, which is it's an ionized gas, and because of that, it's a conductor. And it turns out that magnetism and conductors have big influences on each other. And so the sun's solar wind is actually deflected around the Earth because of the Earth's magnetic field. And one way you experience, maybe not literally you, one way I've experienced this phenomena, since I'm a lot older than you, is that when the Earth's solar wind picks up, it can push on the Earth's magnetic field. So the bigger the push, the more compression we get of the Earth's magnetic field, and that affects things on Earth. Changing magnetic fields cause electric fields. So if we have big loops of wire, like what NSP has all around the country, then we can induce very big and unexpected electric fields in that grid, and we can, as a result, have power outages as fuses blow. Same thing occurs from the northern lights. It turns out that some of the sun's particles can kind of leak in at the north and south pole and make the northern lights. And they're always going on, 24 hours a day, but they're typically not in Minnesota. So the location of the northern lights gets pushed down into Minnesota when we can see them. And I wouldn't be too surprised if none of you have seen northern lights. Yes, no? And that's because for the last 5 years or so, the sun has been in a relatively quiet state. In the last few months, you've probably heard of situations where maybe you could go outside and see the northern lights. Anytime it's happened that I've heard, it's been cloudy, so I haven't seen them. So we're re-entering a period of solar activity. It goes through this 11-year cycle as the sun's magnetic field reverses. And so almost certainly, if you stay in Minnesota at least, you're going to see northern lights in the next 5 years. They should become moderately common. We used to see them all the time when we were just observing for this class 11 years ago. So I was starting to talk about effects. So these are effects that we know are being we're being protected from the Earth's magnetic field. So if the Earth's magnetic field disappeared for a period of thousands of years, then we would get kind of the solar wind directly impinging on the Earth's atmosphere. And turns out that cosmic rays are also being bent away from the Earth by the Earth's magnetic field. So there'd be an increase in the radiation due to cosmic rays. And there's a lot of speculation. I mean, it's hard to connect biological activities and magnetic field switches that happened a million years ago. There's a lot of speculation that it would cause noticeable but not huge effects. So you do know that 65 million years ago, an asteroid hit the Earth and it had profound effects, right? More than 90% of the species were wiped out. So nothing like that, but maybe there would be some sort of effect during this 10,000 year period when the Earth wouldn't be protected by its magnetic field. So again, if you worry about extrapolations, the magnetic field is declining, has been declining for 100 years. But on the other hand, the time scale for this is thousands of years. So unless medicine improves a whole lot, you're not going to see zero magnetic field. So we have not seen any planet, we have not directly observed any planetary magnetic field reversing. We have continually observed the sun's magnetic field reversing on this 11-year cycle. But we can trace back through the effects of magnetic field on rocks, we can trace back reversals in the magnetic field. And in fact, provides the best evidence for the existence of creation of new crust around the mid-ocean ridges. Because if we look at this mid-ocean ridge, so let me look down on it. So here's the crack that the lava is coming out of. It turns out that there are balanced regions. Let me make this more distinct. There are balanced regions on either side. So here maybe would be like the current situation where our North Pole is a South Pole. And then further on, we're going to have a North Pole is reversed. So we have these bands of reversed magnetic field that match on either side of the mid-ocean ridge. And we can date these rocks using radioactive decay, and so we can plot out when the Earth's magnetic field was pointing in its current direction and when it was pointing in different directions, and we can work out the rate at which these mid-ocean ridges are creating new crust. Okay, so that was good evidence in the 60s for what's going on at these mid-ocean ridges. As I say, these days we can actually measure the centimeter per year rate at which things are coming together and moving apart. So there's absolutely no doubt that the process is occurring. Questions? So why is the Earth hot on the inside? Pressure alone doesn't cause temperature. So we've said before that where places that are hot have to be in some sense close to the fire. So there ought to be some sort of heat source that is present in the Earth. And pretty much every bit of everything in the Earth is slightly radioactive. So we always have radioactive decays that are going on in any piece of rock, right? In you, we've talked about carbon-14 radioactively decaying. It turns out that potassium, which is a common element of life, is not uncommonly slightly radioactive. So there are radioactive minerals that are distributed pretty much throughout the interior of the Earth, and that energy is going to be conserved. It has to leak out somehow. Now it turns out, I could say by chance, turns out by chemistry that lots of more than its share of the radioactive material is deposited in our crust. So most of the temperature difference as you go down in the Earth, That is to say, the thing we called the lapse rate before, how much does the temperature go up when you go down? Most of the lapse rate is tied to this crust area where we actually have most of the radioactive material. So that doesn't say there's no radioactive material down here, but this really is pretty pure iron nickel, we think. So there's relatively little. So a lot of the Earth's heat is probably left over from formation. So it's kind of like making a boiled egg, right? It's gonna stay hot on the inside for quite a while before it finally leaks out. So we have residual heat and we have radioactive heat. Those are the sources of the heat that is leaking out from the inside of the Earth and which makes it hotter and hotter and hotter as you go down into the interior of the Earth. So again, the inner core of the Earth we think is hotter than the surface of the Sun. And of course it's a lot closer, but it's a lot more difficult for the Earth to conduct. And that is there's also convection here. But through here and here, most of the energy transfer is in the form of conduction as opposed to convection. Okay. So that's kind of the big picture. Oops, how about the smaller picture? That is to say, if we're actually talking about rocks, you know, how are we going to classify rocks? How are we going to put them together? And there are three broad categories of rock. We've got igneous, sedimentary, and metamorphic. So igneous rocks are rocks that have crystallized out of liquid rock. Obviously hot. Not uncommonly called magma. So the exact nature of that rock is going to depend on its chemical composition and how slowly it cooled. So this is sedimentary rock. Where's my igneous rock? Ah, here it is. So kind of the two most common types of igneous rock that you're probably familiar with are granite and basalt. So this is the Granite City, so you ought to know about granite. Basalt is a very dark rock. And what you can see here is this classification scheme is based on how coarse the crystals are. So if you look at a piece of granite, you can usually see maybe even centimeter-sized separate crystals that are making up the granite. So, I don't know, maybe it's useful to distinguish rock from mineral. So a mineral is a chemically pure substance, and typical rocks are not chemically pure substances. They're mixtures. So if you look at granite, you can see individual crystals of feldspar, pagelocase, mica, all of those in this piece of granite. So what we're distinguishing here is how coarse those grains are. And that's a matter of how slowly the rock cooled. If the rock cooled over a long period of time, millions of years, then it has time to grow relatively big crystals. On the other hand, if it cooled very quickly, then it doesn't have time to form big crystals, and it's going to have very small, typically invisible without a microscope or some sort of magnification, crystalline structure. So the other thing that's being distinguished here is basically mafic rocks that have a large fraction of metals in them and lower density rock that have a large amount of silicon in them. So here we have lots of potassium and feldspar, and here we would have lots of iron, and the colors correspond. That is to say, generally speaking, granite is a lower density, lighter colored rock compared to basalt, which I would say is dead black, and has a corresponding higher density. Okay, so we can distinguish igneous rock based on the crystal size. And that's a matter of telling you the cooling time. And cooling time is often related to how the igneous rock was produced. So if you're thinking igneous rocks, you're probably thinking about volcanoes. And that's a relatively unusual way of making igneous rocks. More commonly, we have plutonic rocks. And those are cases where a body of liquid rock is underground and never comes above ground and cools below ground and solidifies below ground. And maybe after some erosion, some of that igneous rock will come to the surface. So a plutonic rock, plutonic rock, cooled slowly under the surface and therefore is likely to have relatively big grains. Obsidian, I guess it's not on this thing, is a very glassy rock that forms by very quickly cooling rock, and that's more common in volcanic sorts of situations. And also we have the distinction between the mafic rocks and the corresponding felsic rocks, which are, so the mafic rocks are rich in iron and magnesium. The felsic rocks have lots of feldspar and silicon oxide in general. Okay, so rhyolite, granite have pretty much the same chemical composition, but this guy cooled more quickly, and so it has smaller crystals than the corresponding granite has. If we're looking at rocks that are in the mantle, we're looking at mafic rocks that have a relatively low silicon oxide concentration, peridite being a very typical example of rocks that are considered to be part of the mantle. Okay, so sedimentary rocks. Okay, so I had sedimentary rocks a moment ago. So sedimentary rocks are rocks that are deposited subfluvially. And I don't know, 90% of the time, the fluid we're talking about is water. So we're thinking about things that are being produced under the ocean. But we can have things like sandstones that are a result of depositions under air. So we can have sand dunes that have become solid rock. So the sand itself was deposited under the fluid that is air, and then it became rock over time. Ooh, this is... So this is not... So this is more igneous rocks. Yeah, so here we have mafic and felsic. So this is going the... So what's the third dimension here? So we have silicon, we have other minerals by volume. Yeah, okay, so we have the plutonic rocks, we've got the coarse grain rocks. This is more, this is just more detail. Okay, so where are my sedimentary rocks? Here we go. So typical examples of sedimentary rock are going to be things like sandstone. So sandstone is sand that has had typically had minerals deposited typically by fluids flowing through the sandstone. Minerals deposited that cement the sand together to make a rock. And here, of course, the the size of the things that are put together is going to be key. So we can have clays where we have very fine material, or we can have boulders that are cemented together to make radically different grain sizes. And often the grain size is going to tell you about the nature of the fluid that deposited it. So if we have boulders, that typically indicates that we had very fast moving water that was able to move those boulders together. On the other hand, clays and silts are things that are going to be deposited under calmer circumstances like lake bottoms. So we also have chemical sediments that can exist, and probably the chief example of that is going to be limestones. Where are limestones? So dolomite is a modified limestone. Oh, here. Oh, I see. We have here are our limestones. So these things are chemically precipitate out, particularly under warm evaporating oceans. And we can also have things like salt. So this is normal table salt, sodium chloride, is often part of an evaporite. So sitting under the city of Detroit, there are a huge layer of salt, and that's what they use to keep their roads clear in the summer. It's right at hand. Okay. So we can have chemical, and we can have literally just where we have other pebbles made of all sorts of different things that are cemented together to make sedimentary rocks. Metamorphic rocks. So metamorphic rocks are rocks of one of these other two types, or other metamorphic rocks, which have been subjected to extra heat and pressure, and that's noticeably changed their composition. So above, subjected to additional heat and pressure, and that can change the results. So gneiss, that's spelled with a G, gneiss is a typical example of a metamorphic rock that typically has its origin in granites. Okay, so three types of rock types and kind of how they form and what role they play. I want to come back for a second and talk some about igneous rocks. I drew this picture of a volcano. So Mount Fujiyama, for example, it's, you know, a typical sort of volcano that has these sort of steep sides. Those turn out to be relatively rare on other planetary systems. These are called composite volcanoes. Much more common in the solar system are what are called shield volcanoes. So shield volcanoes are kind of like a shield that has been put face down. They have relatively slow slopes. And of course, the difference is the viscosity of the lava. Right, so if we have lava that flows freely, then we're going to have relatively mild slopes. If we have lava that isn't going to flow very far, it's going to stick together and make a relatively big volcano. What determines the height of a volcano? So it turns out there are particularly big volcanoes on Mars. And sometimes people say that that's because the gravitational field is small on Mars. It's a lower mass planet. And that's not the case. So this all has to do with isostatic balance. Right? So if we're going to have lava that is pushed up, then we have to have a pressure down here that supports the density, the acceleration, and the corresponding height. And that pressure has to come from the overlying rocks, which also have a density, acceleration of gravity, and some different height. And you can see if the pressure is caused by the layers of overlying rock, then these things have to be the same. and the acceleration of gravity simply cancels out. So if you want to have really high volcanoes, then you want to have relatively low density lava, and rock is pretty much rock, so it's the density is probably not the key feature. The key feature is probably more the depth. So if the source of the magma is low, then we have a much greater distance that we have for the difference in density to work on. So signs of tall volcanoes are more indicative of the depth of the corresponding magma source than they are anything to do with the acceleration of gravity on the surface of the planet, because we're looking for isostatic equilibrium where pressures are caused by pressures. The reason the magma can go high is because it has a relatively low density, because it's hot, compared to the corresponding rock. Okay. Now, I commented that not all mountains on Earth are in isostatic equilibrium, right? So I gave the Appalachians as an example of one that seems to be in isostatic equilibrium, and the Himalayas do not appear to be in isostatic equilibrium. Is there any way we can tell the difference? Tell the difference between a situation where we have, you know, something that looks like this, where we have just rocks that are piled up on top of the surface, right? So here, obviously, the weight of this is more than the weight of that. So that's an example of non-isostatic equilibrium. Or whether we, in fact, have some sort of balancing that is pushing the mountain up high. And we can get it. So obviously, if we have seismic instruments, we're all set. But so we can see the root of the mountains directly under those circumstances. But as I said, with the exception of the Earth and the Moon, we don't have seismometers sitting on the surface of any body. It turns out that spacecraft that are in orbit can detect the gravitational influence of the mountains, and they can put a handle on the extent that we have isostatic balance. So whether we have this other low-density rock present or not is going to affect what the gravitational force that this spacecraft feels, which is going to affect the orbit of the corresponding spacecraft. So we can get a handle on isostatic balance by looking at close-running orbits of satellites. And in fact, there's been a pretty recent pair of satellites that have been mapping the gravitational field of the Earth. They're European satellites that have recently released good data on the distribution of mass inside the Earth, just based on gravitational data, not based on seismic data. About the only other piece of evidence we're going to have for other planets has to do with their moment of inertia. Now remember, we talked about moment of inertia when we were talking about spinning objects. And we said that just as the momentum of an object depends on its mass and its velocity, the angular momentum of an object depends on its spin rate and some quantity that had to do with the distribution of mass and radius. And we could distinguish between, like, how long it took to roll down an inclined plane. We could distinguish things that had all of their mass on the outside, like a hoop, and things that had their mass distributed uniformly, like a ball. Right? So you remember the ball was faster to roll down the incline because its kind of average radius was smaller because the mass was distributed uniformly throughout the object. So we can measure how planets respond to forces, torques actually, twisting forces, And so we can measure the moment of inertia of these planets, and we can get a handle on the distribution of mass. So if an object is uniform, it turns out that the moment of inertia depends, it has a two-fifths factor, depending times the mass times the radius squared. If there is, as there is for the Earth, if we have concentrated mass at the core, then this number is going to be smaller. So this again is not great evidence, but it can show us, it can show the extent to which the planet is differentiated. That is to say, the extent to which the heavy stuff has gone to the center and the light stuff is on the top. So for the Jovian planets, which are gaseous with a rock core, that coefficient of the moment of inertia, this two-fifths, is going to be unusually small. Whereas for an asteroid or something that is pretty much uniform rock, that moment of inertia is going to be pretty much the two-fifths, the 0.4 value. Okay, so for planets, we have much more limited data on what the interior structure is. Most of what we know about the interior structure of planets is based on calculations, and calculations can be wrong. We think we're doing them right, but there's always something new to learn. And always good reasons to try and put seismometers on the surface of these sorts of planets. As I say, we've done it for the moon, but not for any of the other planets, for good reason. It'll be a long time coming. Questions? So I want to take up one final issue about materials. And this has to do with my statement that high pressures lead to solidification. Because it's not always that way. So you may notice that ice skating works really well, but concrete skating doesn't work really well. Tar skating doesn't work real well. So what is it about ice that allows you to slide almost frictionlessly on top of the surface, particularly if you have a relatively narrow piece of metal that is making contact, right? That sounds disastrous in the case of concrete, but it works pretty well in the case of ice. And it turns out that ice is a relatively unusual piece of material because at kind of normal sort of conditions, so these are pressures, and kind of normal atmospheric pressure is 0.1 megapascals, so right about here. Under normal conditions, it turns out that if you add pressure, you can go, it's hard to see, this line is slightly tilted in. Let me redraw it with exaggeration. So this is pressure versus temperature, and it turns out that at this location, this line is slightly pushed in, so if you just add pressure to ice, you can convert it from a solid to a liquid. So what you're skating on when you have a high pressure, when you have all of your weight pushing on that very small surface area of the skate blade, you have a very high pressure, and one of the things you're doing is you're making a liquid layer of water directly underneath your skate. So you're not skating literally on the solid, you're skating on the liquid that you produced by high pressure. If you walk with your shoes, it may be a little bit slippery, but it's nothing like as slippery as it is with ice skates, because now the same weight is being distributed over a much larger area, and you remember that pressure is the force per area. Right, so the skate blade has a very small area, same force, high pressure. Your shoes have a larger area, same force, lower pressure. So this transformation is less likely to occur. It turns out you can show in thermodynamics that this relatively unusual behavior, where this separation line between liquid and solid is tilted that way, that is 100% caused by the fact that if you freeze water, it doesn't shrink, it expands. And that has to be the case, right? Because you know that low-density things float, and you know ice floats, so it must be that water, frozen water, has a lower density than liquid water. And that has important facts for lots of things, like keeping the lakes from freezing solid, right? We get this layer of solid ice which prevents convection, and it keeps the keeps the lower layers of the lake in their liquid form, because we can't get the heat out of them through conduction. Yes. So if the scale here is pretty incredible, though, right? So this is room temperature. This is below the temperature of dry ice. And so, yeah. So if you get really, 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 really cold, probably colder than it gets on Earth, then you shouldn't be able to ice skate as well. The other thing that would kill ice skating is if you had much higher pressure. So do notice that this behavior, that when you subject ice to greater pressure, you can convert it from solid to liquid, that disappears if we get huge pressures. And we go back to the normal situation, where because this thing is tilted in this direction, that means that under these circumstances, when you go from liquid water under these huge pressures to solid water, then the water is going to be compressed. So you may notice that there are lots of things labeled ice, ice 1, ice 2, ice 3, ice 4. Those are different crystalline structures for ice. So the crystalline structure that we have for ice changes, for example, when we go from this pressure to that pressure. And instead of having ice being in its normal kind of hexangular form, we'd have a different crystalline structure. And it's going to have different pressures and densities when we get this sort of transformation. So I commented, I'm not sure if you noticed in detail, the slight changes in the speed of all of these little zigs and zags that you have for the density as a function of depth in the Earth. Those are due to these sort of phase transformations, where here it's probably the same rock type as it is there, but that rock type is in a different crystalline form, a greater density crystalline form, because of the higher pressure. Okay, so all of these crystals can be in different forms at different temperatures and densities, and the thermodynamics of which form is stable depends on those temperature and densities. Mm-hmm. There should be an ice everything. I don't see one listed here. I didn't notice the absence of an ice four. So it is possible that there isn't one. I can't tell you off the top of my head that there isn't. If there isn't one, then it's kind of an historical artifact that somebody published that, I discovered this new type of ice called ice four, and then it turned out to be wrong 10 years later. But by that time, they'd find 5, 6, and 7, so they didn't want to rename them. So I can't tell you for sure that didn't happen. You may have heard of this author, Kurt Vonnegut, who wrote a book about ice 9, which didn't exist at the time, that had special properties which were not good for the planet, which I'm not sure I want to describe now. But it turns out that there is now an ice 9. It doesn't have any of the properties that Kurt Vonnegut described. But it just exists at very, very high pressures. So this is an ongoing game. So incidentally, We can recreate extremely high pressures in our laboratories by using what are called diamond anvils. And they're very simple. They simply are two diamond crystals that are pushed together. And diamond is a particularly stable form. And you can, just by turning a screw, you can achieve tremendous pressures. We can't currently simultaneously make the high temperatures and pressures that are present at the solid inner core. We can do a pretty good job of simulating in our laboratories the conditions kind of there. So we have a really good idea about what the rock types are at various situations. Diamond itself is maybe worthy of a little bit of explanation, because diamond is carbon, right? Right? So the carbon that you have in your pencils is also carbon. Graphite. These are two different crystalline forms of carbon. And the crystalline form that is the expensive crystalline form, that's formed deep under the earth where we have particularly high pressures. It's not stable on the surface of the earth. That is to say, given its choice, your diamond would like to turn into carbon. It would be energetically favorable to do that. But luckily that conversion happens at a slow enough rate that you don't have to worry about it unless you have an exponentially enlarged lifetime. I briefly mentioned critical points at one point. So this is also kind of a funny thing that is maybe worth explaining. So the difference between air and water is obvious. And it's kind of surprising that that distinction disappears at high enough pressure. So at high enough pressure, there is no distinction between water vapor and liquid water. And where that distinction disappears, and of course the distinction is based on a difference in density, right? Low density vapor, high density liquid. Where that distinction disappears is called a critical point. And our book likes to talk about the giant planets as they're typically called gas giant planets. And they say, well, they're really liquid planets. And I will correct them one more time and say, well, it's actually past the critical point. So there isn't a distinction between gases and liquids at the pressures that are present inside the gas giant planets. So I will continue to occasionally use the word gas giant as opposed to Jovian planet. Okay. So early on, we said that a typical Earth rock was something like 100 million years old. And that's, of course, because of this recycling process. Right? Rocks are always being created and destroyed. So what this is saying is the typical lifetime of a piece of crust is on the order of 100 billion years old. The old continental crust can be older, right? So we said that the banded iron formation in northern Minnesota, which is at the core of our continental crust, is like 2 billion years old. So one of the things that we can put a handle on based on Earth is occasionally things do hit the Earth and they leave a pot mark. They leave a crater. Meteor Crater National Park. Is it a national park or just a sub? Well, we'll call it a national park. I'm not sure. Meteor Crater National Park is an example of that, where we have a nearly mile-wide crater in western United States, left from a meteor impact of long ago. And you know, I hope you know that 65 million years ago we had this extinction event where a much bigger rock hit off the Yucatan in Mexico. And that crater is under the ocean, but it's been discovered by sonic sounding. So we do have these pot marks, and one of the things we can do is figure out the rate at which they're occurring. So we can count the number of pot marks and basically divide it by how old the surface is, and we can get an average rate at which pot marks are produced. Right? So we can get a cratering rate. And the first thing we discover is that the current cratering rate can't explain things like the moon, which are basically 100% cratered. And on reflection, that makes sense, right? Presumably, there were a lot more rocks floating around 4 billion years ago than there are now, because they've been collected onto planets. So currently, the cratering rate is probably a lot lower than it was 4 billion years ago. And in fact, we can make calculations of the cratering rate, and it looks like it went through some peak about 4 billion years ago. And that's when most of the cratering occurred on the moon. We do have some younger surfaces on the moon, things that date to more like the 2 billion years that I was talking about for the banded iron formation, and they have substantially fewer craters than the heavily cratered parts of the moon. But one thing we can for sure do is we can order the age of a surface based on the number of craters. Right? So if we see one terrain, you know, that has a few odd craters in it, and we see another terrain that is cheek to jowl with craters, you know, that's kind of a no-brainer that this one is young and this one is old. It's a little bit trickier process to actually put a date on those things. Right? Because then we need to know what this cratering rate has been at all the possible times, and there's always a degree of uncertainty about that. But we can always at least date things according to, we can always sort things in time age, even if we can't assign a really nice particular year to those to that phenomena. Now, one of the nice things about the moon is we have sent people there, and they have picked up rocks from these sort of surfaces, and we can take them back to the lab, and we can date them using radioactive materials. So we can get a calibration for this curve. We haven't visited the moon all that many times, so there's still a certain degree of uncertainty. And even more problematic, if we try and apply that to Mars, say, we're making an assumption that the rocks that were hitting the moon and the Earth were the same sort of rocks that were hitting Mars. But, you know, Mars is closer to the asteroid belt. If we apply this to Mercury, we have to make the assumption that things were more or less the same where we can calibrate it, where we've actually visited, compared to the surface of Mercury. And let me kind of briefly describe for the terrestrial planets, which are of course the only ones that we have surfaces that can leave pot marks. If we look at the moon and Mercury, they both look about the same. They both have lots of heavily cratered areas. They also both have regions where there are relatively few craters, but you know, nothing like the number of craters that are, for example, in America, but relatively few craters, presumably several billion years old as opposed to being 4 billion years old. And we've got Mars, which is a little bit different in a sense that I'll come back to in a second. And then we've got Venus, and the Earth has astonishingly few pot marks in it. Some that you know are famous enough that we make national parks surrounding them, but actually there are any number of meteor impact craters in Minnesota, but they don't exist as obvious pot marks because they've been erased by glaciation and things like that. So the reason I left Mars out is that it's odd. So about roughly speaking, approximately speaking, the northern hemisphere has relatively few craters, and the southern hemisphere looks just like the moon and Mercury. It has basically 100% craters. So there's some pretty obvious dimorphism that's going on in Mars that's leading to relatively new material, still probably billions of years old, but relatively new material for a large fraction of the planet, and lots of relatively old material like the moon and Mercury. And there's kind of a logic to this that's worth describing, and it should be familiar to you. And that is, how long does it take for something to cool off, right? Presumably, the resurfacing processes we've talked about depend on how much heat is stored in the planet and how long it takes it to cool off. If you've ever done grinding, you've noticed incandescent sparks that are at very high temperature that are being spat out by the grinding process. But almost instantaneously, they reach room temperature. So if they hit your arm while you're grinding something, it's kind of no hassle. On the other hand, the boiled egg that we were talking about before can stay uncomfortably hot for many, many, many minutes, maybe as long as an hour. So the size of the planet is going to play a key role in how long it takes it to cool off. And once it's cooled off, the sort of processes that we've been talking about are going to end, and we're not going to have new crust creation that's going to destroy the features that were created in the past. And this makes sense because the moon and Mercury are the smallest objects on this list Mars is kind of intermediate. Venus is pretty much the same size as the Earth. And in fact, Venus is so similar to the Earth that we're going to be hard put to explain why Venus is different from the Earth. Okay, so in terms of meteorology and geology, we know 100 times as much about the Earth as we do about the other planets. So the plan is kind of to apply that knowledge to these other planets and see how they're different and how they're the same. And unfortunately, it's 90% difference and 10% the same. The planets really are very different from the Earth. And it kind of needs to be explained.